This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
In a courtroom in Leon County this March, something unusual happened. Donna Adelson's defense team returned to court, not to argue about evidence found on the phone or wiretaps or any of the expected stuff in the murder-for-hire case that we've become all too familiar with, but to make a renowned and renewed plea to keep a novel out of her upcoming trial. Yes, a novel, a work of fiction, right? Or is it? A book called This Is Our Story, written by her daughter, you guessed it, Wendy Adelson. A book that prosecution says paints a picture of not just of Wendy's state of mind, but of Donna's own alleged motive in the killing of her former son-in-law, Dan Markell. Pretty big allegation right there. It's not every day that a murder case turns into the pages of a novel, but here we are. Now, This Is Our Story isn't some obscure diary or private journal that was accidentally uncovered. No, it was actually published in 2011, 3 years before Markell's 2014 shooting, and marketed as a semi-autobiographical debut from a young lawyer turned author who at the time was also Markell's ex-wife. And for the last decade, it sat relatively unnoticed. But as prosecutors built out the picture of what they say was a family conspiracy to get rid of Dan Markell, they zeroed in on this book. Because in the eyes of the state, This Is Our Story is more than fiction. It's a map of motive. But how so? Donna Adelson's attorneys are now fighting hard to keep the book far away from the courtroom. They're doing so for a reason. Once you hear what's inside it and how closely it lines up with real life events, you'll understand why. Let's back up a bit, though. On March 27th, 2025, in Tallahassee, the courtroom, defense attorneys for Donna Adelson stood before Judge Stephen Everett and asked him for the second time to rule that the jury should never see or hear about This Is Our Story. They argued that it's fiction, that it's irrelevant, and that it was written and published in 2011, long before the events. Yeah. They argued it has nothing to do with Donna Adelson. And most importantly, they argued that if the jury hears it, they might get confused or worse, start seeing metaphors as a motive. So to be fair, these aren't outlandish arguments. In most trials, fiction doesn't get to testify. Defense attorney Marissa Vickers told the court that the book closely resembles parts of Wendy Adelson's life. Sure, but also noted that parts of it diverge significantly. For example, there's a line in the book where the main character, Lily, thanks her husband for bringing her to North Florida. A direct contradiction, Vickers argued, that the prosecution's theory that Wendy felt trapped in Tallahassee and she was desperate to leave, and the book doesn't quite say that. It just says it in different areas. But the state sees it a little differently. Prosecutors say this book isn't about plot lines or metaphors. It's about what it reveals. Plainly about how Wendy Adelson felt during her marriage, how she viewed her husband, how she viewed her life in North Florida, and how when she wrote fiction, she imagined a future without her husband and on her own terms. While Wendy is not on trial this round, her mother, Donna, is. And prosecutors argue that understanding Wendy's mindset helps establish the alleged motive behind what they claim was a family operation to have Dan Markell killed. So who's right? And why is the book such a big deal? Let's talk about timing. This isn't a newly discovered manuscript. Like I said, the book was originally self-published in 2011, then picked up and re-released by Carolina Academic Press in 2013, about a year before Dan Markell was shot in his driveway, allegedly by hitmen connected to Wendy's brother, Charlie Adelson. So from a purely chronological standpoint, the defense is right. The book came out before the murder. The prosecutors say that's exactly why it matters. Because they're not saying the book caused anything. They're saying it reveals quite a bit. According to court records and public statements, the state believes the book serves as a kind of prelude, a window into Wendy's frustration with her marriage and her life, and a signal to her family that she wanted out. More than out, she wanted a clean slate. The book doesn't describe a murder, but it does describe a woman who, by the end of the story, has completely cut her husband out of her life, adopted a baby without his input, given the baby her maiden name, and told her husband to stay away. It is fiction, yes, but it also hits a little too close to home. What makes all this more complicated is how the prosecution wants to use the book. They don't intend to introduce it as some kind of confession. They're not saying this book is the murder plot disguised as literature. Instead, they say it offers that rare, unfiltered look into how Wendy Adelson viewed her world, and more specifically, how she viewed her ex-husband, Dan Markell. They believe that Wendy's outlook, as expressed in the novel, helps illustrate why the Adelson family might have wanted Dan out of the picture. And since Donna is now accused of orchestrating the murder-for-hire plot, they say Wendy's mindset helps explain Donna's motivation. It's all about building the frame. And the book, they say, is part of that frame. So back in court this March, Donna Adelson's legal team didn't argue that the book was fiction. They also tried to pick apart its relevance. They claim that any connection between the book and the crime is completely circumstantial, speculative, and prejudicial. In plain English, it might sound spooky, but it doesn't prove anything. And letting jurors hear about it would be unfair. That argument already lost once. In September of 24, Judge Everett denied an earlier motion to exclude the book, siding with prosecutors who argued that it had enough probative value to be considered. But Donna has new counsel now, and they're hoping the judge will reconsider, especially after they emphasize the new details, like the fact that the book was published well before the custody battles and relocation fights that are central to the alleged motives in this case. They're also leaning heavily on the idea that the book's fictional plot lines are too distant from the facts. Wendy's character in the book, Lily, if you want to call her Wendy's character, is married to a man named Josh, not Dan. Big changes there. Lily is working on immigration and human trafficking cases, completely unrelated to the world of custody disputes. And as mentioned earlier, there's that detail where Lily thanks her husband for moving her to Florida, an awkward contradiction to the real-life picture of Wendy as someone who desperately wanted to leave. But here's the thing. In criminal trials, it's not always about proving every single fact lines up. Sometimes it's about tone. It's about patterns, about the things that don't sit right. And that's what the prosecution is leaning into. They say the similarities between the book and Wendy's life are way too strong to ignore. They believe it lays out an emotional roadmap where not a crime, but a motive that Donna Adelson may have shared, encouraged, or maybe even acted on. Of course, none of this has been decided yet. Judge Everett has not ruled as of this moment on the renewed motion, but in court he made it clear he's weighing both sides carefully, because what's really at stake here isn't just whether a book gets read aloud in court. It's whether that book will be allowed to shape how a jury understands one of the most unusual murder cases in recent memory. There's a tension here that's hard to ignore. On one hand, we're talking about a fictional story, a novel, the kind you could buy online, read on a plane, and forget about a week later. On the other hand, this novel might be doing the very thing that Donna Adelson's defense fears worst, speaking for Wendy, giving jurors a glimpse into Wendy's thoughts and emotions that Donna's lawyers can't cross-examine, can't fact-check, and can't fully control. It's like trying to put a character on the stand, but the character was created by the defendant's own daughter, and she sounds an awful lot like the real Wendy. And remember, Wendy Adelson is expected to testify in her mother's trial, so this novel could become a kind of shadow witness lurking in the background, echoing the words that she says, or worse, contradicting it. That's why the defense is fighting so hard to keep it out. They know the power of the narrative. They know that sometimes, especially with juries, narrative wins. The prosecution, for their part, seems well aware of the risks, too. They've been careful in how they discuss the book, acknowledging that it is fiction, but insisting that its value lies in what it shows about motive, not facts. They've hinted that this may be something where they only seek to introduce excerpts, just like very specific passages from the book, not the novel as a whole. Well, that could also be enough to get the past judges' concerns about confusion and prejudice a little more weight. And if even a few lines from the book make it in front of the jury, that could be enough to leave a lasting impression. So, as we wait for Judge Everett's ruling, the courtroom is holding its breath. A fictional story about a woman finding independence may soon become a pivotal piece of a real murder trial. Whether it's admitted or excluded, this is our story, is already shaping how the story is being told. The big question is, what exactly does this book say? And how close does fiction come to fact? This Is Our Story isn't a courtroom exhibit. It's that novel, one, again, at face value, appears to be about human trafficking. But beneath that surface, just a few pages in, it becomes something else entirely. A portrait, a memoir, a fiction so tightly stitched to real life that it feels like a rough draft of reality. Again, the book first published in 2011. Wendy Adelson, then a young lawyer with academic ambitions, released it as her debut novel. Didn't exactly make waves at the time. No bestseller list, and I think the last time I checked it on Amazon, it had like 5 reviews. Just a quiet release with a striking cover and a summary about immigration, legal advocacy, and a young attorney's fight for justice. But those who actually read it, especially now with the benefit of hindsight, see something very different. Again, at the center of the story is Lily Stone. She's 30-something, bright, idealistic, and recently married. She gives up a high-powered job in Washington, D.C., and follows her husband, Josh Stone, to a small university town in North Florida called Hiawassee Springs. You don't need a map to know that's code for Tallahassee. It's like you just kind of rearrange some of the letters and you get that. In North Florida? University town? Yeah. It's not exactly subtle. As soon as Lily arrives, she hates it. The house Josh has picked is a mess, roach-infested, dirty, a far cry from the life she imagined. And her career stalls. She struggles to find purpose. And her marriage? It starts to curdle almost immediately. Josh is pinned as a well-meaning but small person, both literally and figuratively. Lily complains about his pet names, his habits, and his general presence. The more time she spends in Hiawassee Springs, the more she feels boxed in, like she's living someone else's life, Josh's life. So she starts to create her own. Lily throws herself into pro bono immigration work, eventually taking on the cases of two young women, Mila and Rosa, who've been trafficked into the United States under the false promise and brutal conditions. Their stories, full of abuse and coercion, make up much of the plot's external conflict. But while those cases are meant to provide some sort of structure, the emotional heartbeat of the novel is always about Lily. It's about her internal war between obligation and freedom, identity and family, her husband's version of her future, and the one she wants for herself. And slowly but surely, Lily begins to sever the ties. There's no single moment where Lily flips a switch. It's a slow burn, a mounting frustration that simmers into resolve. Her relationship with Josh deteriorates in every single chapter. There are cold dinners, missed signals, hostile sentences, and eventually Lily takes a step that changes everything. She adopts a baby without telling Josh. The baby, born to one of the trafficking victims, becomes the center of Lily's new world. She names the child Anna, gives her Lily's last name, Walker, her maiden name, not Josh's, not Stone. And when she finally tells Josh about the adoption, she doesn't ask for his opinion. She tells him flat out that she wants to raise a child on her own, that her life is going to be a different direction. that he isn't a part of it anymore. Josh cries, pleads, but Lily is firm. She's moving on. She's taking back her name, too, planning to revert to Walker after the divorce is final. The last time we see them together, they're sitting across from each other in a diner. He's broken. She's resolute. The message is clear. This isn't a partnership anymore. It's a clean break. Now, pause there for a second. The last name thing? That's not just a story beat. In real life, after Dan Markell's murder, Wendy Adelson filed to change her name and her children's last names from Markell to Adelson. She even removed a middle name that had honored one of Dan's relatives. She did it within a year of his death. Just like Lily, Wendy created a new narrative, one where the father was no longer a part of the picture. Not dead, just not part of the picture. The parallels don't stop at the names. Lily's disdain for her life in Hiawassee Springs is a constant refrain in the book. She calls it a godforsaken place, complains about the bugs, the small-town culture, the isolation. It's hard not to hear echoes of real-world discontent. According to communications obtained by investigators, Wendy herself expressed frustration in the life that she was living in Tallahassee. She wanted to move back to South Florida, closer to her family, closer to Donna. But Dan wouldn't agree to the relocation. The court said no, so she stayed. For a time. Back in the book, Josh isn't physically abusive. He's not a villain. He's just in the way. The obstacle to Lily's new beginning and the way she removes him is clean, legally, emotionally, surgically. She builds a new family unit around herself and her adopted daughter with no room left for the man she once married. Again, all fiction, sure. But when you read it alongside the facts, the tone gets harder to ignore. Because a trafficking storyline, that's not the part people remember. That's not the part that gets prosecutors and defense attorneys lining up in court to argue over admissibility. It's the undercurrent, the personal narrative, the way Lily, and by extension, Wendy, writes about control, about escape, about reshaping her life, her family, her future, on her terms, without the man who tied her down. That's what prosecutors say matters, not the plot about immigration, visas, or corrupt traffickers, but the voice behind it, a woman who is clearly and unapologetically using fiction to work something out, to say the things she maybe couldn't say out loud, to imagine a life without her husband, a life she ultimately creates, both in the book and, according to the prosecution, in reality. Wendy has never denied that book draws from her real life. She's described it as semi-autobiographical. And it doesn't take a literary scholar to figure out which parts come from experience. The setting, the dynamics, the marriage, even the character names, Lily Stone, Josh Stone, carry that familiar ring. She may not be Lily in every detail, but she's Lily where it counts. And in the book, Lily gets what she wants. A life of independence, a daughter to raise, a future on her terms. Josh, for all his tears, fades into the background. Conveniently, right? In real life, Wendy eventually got something that looked very similar. Two children, a return to South Florida, and no more Dan Markell in the picture. The road to that ending was much darker. Markell was shot in his driveway in July of 2014. Police say the murder was a murder-for-hire plot, and Wendy, while never charged, was surrounded by family members who allegedly played a part. Her brother Charlie, now convicted. Her mother Donna, awaiting trial. In court findings, prosecutors argue that This Is Our Story gives them a crucial tool to explain motive. Not Wendy's alone, but the family's. They believe the book shows that Wendy wanted and that her family, particularly Donna, helped her get what she wanted. But the defense pushes back hard. They say that It's a novel again. It's not a roadmap. That any parallels are purely coincidental. The story was written before the murders, before the custody battle, before the relocation denials. They say the book is being twisted into something it's not, evidence. And maybe that's true. Maybe it is a fictional character's journey, and it shouldn't be used to explain real-life actions. But then again, when fiction looks this familiar, it's hard not to look closer. Because even if Lily isn't Wendy and Josh isn't Dan, the emotional shape of the story still fits. Woman who wants a different life, a man who won't bend, a family reshaped around the absence of its father. In the book, it's tidy, neat, paperwork and conversation. In real life, it was anything but. Still, the bones of the story are the same. Whether or not this novel makes it into court, it's already made its way into the narrative. It's become part of the broader story about control, about motive, and about a family that is going to do what they want. They're dynamic, very similar, and that prosecutors say turned deadly. While the trafficking plot might be what, again, sells the book, it's the domestic subplot, the resentment, the reinvention, the erasure. That is everyone's attention. Let's take a look at the courtroom, though. What could possibly happen there? And prosecutors, if they are able to, take it in and prove some points with it. How they plan to use it, what legal doors it opens, and what ones it threatens to slam shut. And what happens when a jury is asked to decide how much truth they believe can live inside a piece of fiction. So when it comes down to it, a murder trial is about story, not fiction, not novels, but the story that the prosecution can prove and the one the defense can dismantle. And in the case against Donna Adelson, the prosecution believes they've got a piece of that story sitting between the covers of her daughter's book. They're not arguing that this is our story is a confession. They're not suggesting it's the how-to manual. But what they are saying clearly and deliberately is that the novel offers that rare look into a life and Wendy Adelson's mindset. And that mindset, they say, you can begin to understand Donna Adelson's alleged motive. Here's the crux of it, the motive, the why. Because the evidence against Donna isn't based on DNA or surveillance footage. The case is built on relationships, resentment, and what prosecutors describe as deep and shared desire to remove a man, Dan Markell, from the lives of a family that felt boxed in by him. What better way to show that collective desire, they argued, than through the words of Wendy herself that she wrote years before? They plan to use the book to do two things, illustrate Wendy's motive and to frame Donna's intent. It's not a one-to-one correlation. Wendy isn't on trial yet. She's never been charged. But the prosecutors believe that Donna, as Wendy's mother, would have understood that her daughter's frustrations were real. And more than that, would have taken action to help fix the problem. If Wendy felt stuck in Tallahassee, unable to move her children back to Miami and trapped in the shadow of her ex-husband, then Donna, the state says, had every reason to want Dan out of the way. It's a theory built not on one smoking gun, but again, on 1,000 slow-burning details. The This Is Us story, they say, is one of those details. That's why they're pushing to bring it into the courtroom, not to prove that Wendy fantasized about murder, but to show how badly she wanted to erase Dan from her family's life. And if Donna shared that motive or acted on it, then the book becomes relevant not as fact, but as emotional context, if you will, a glimpse into the family's private narrative, one that ended with a public killing. The legal mechanism for introducing this kind of evidence is tricky. Fiction doesn't usually get a seat at the table at a murder trial, but the prosecution has a play here, and it hinges on something called the state of mind exception to hearsay. Normally, anything someone says outside of court, especially in writing, is considered hearsay. It can't be used to prove the truth of what it says. But if the statement reflects the speaker's emotional state, that emotional state is relevant to the case, then it can come in. So the prosecutors aren't arguing that anything in the book happened the way it's written. They're saying that the book, again, reveals how Wendy felt. It shows her resentment, her restlessness, her need to start fresh, and her desire to do it without her husband. And if Donna knew that and acted with that in mind, again, then the book puts that picture together of that family-wide conspiracy. Now, not everyone agrees this is fair play. Legal experts are divided on it. Some say it's clever, a little unorthodox. Others say it is trial by metaphor, warning that introducing fiction into a criminal trial sets a dangerous precedent, because even if the judge reminds the jury that the book is not fact, once it's in their heads, it's in. Jurors are human. They react to narrative. If they see Wendy as this woman desperate to escape her ex, then they learn that Dan Markell was murdered. It's not a stretch to connect the dots emotionally, even if the evidence doesn't connect them legally. That's the defense's concern, that the jury will latch onto that story, not the evidence. That they'll be swayed by tone, suggestion, by the eerie coincidences in arts mirroring life. The risk isn't just confusion, it's prejudice. The idea that Wendy wrote the ending she wanted, that the ending actually happened, although there was no murder in the book. So the judge has options. He can allow the book in full or in part. He can restrict it to certain excerpts. He can provide strict instructions to the jury, laying out exactly what the book can be considered for and what it can't. Or he can exclude it altogether, deciding that the risk of unfair influence outweighs any potential value. And make no mistake here, if it comes in, it will be controlled. The trafficking subplot, irrelevant. The focus will be on the marriage, the adoption, the name changes, the emotional pivot where Lily cuts her husband out of the picture. Those are the lines prosecutors want the jury to hear. Public commentary, especially from the true crime world, has been a little less reserved. People who followed this case for years have pored over the This Is Us story, finding every line, every turn of the phrase that seems to echo what happened after Dan Markell's murder. The online community is filled with posts describing the novel as a chilling and unsettling, a window into a motive. Legal bloggers have unpacked the parallels, noting how Wendy's fiction is so closely on track with the aftermath of Dan's death, particularly her swift moves to change the children's names and several ties after the Markell family. But it's not just about the public buzz. The legal implications are real. The book, if it is admitted, gives the prosecution a unique edge, the ability to argue motive not with just witness statements or emails, but with Wendy's own words. Even though Wendy is not coerced, not charged, her testimony is expected to be central in this case. She's not a peripheral player. She's the bridge between Donna and Dan. The entire narrative hinges on what she knew, what she felt, and what her family allegedly did on her behalf. So imagine her on the stand, answering questions about her relationship with Dan, about her life in Tallahassee, about her feelings during the custody fight. Then imagine the prosecution pulling out the book, not to accuse her of writing a confession, couldn't have happened before, but to point to how she wrote about those feelings in fiction, to ask the jury, is this really fiction? Or is this the blueprint of a motive? Or is this just someone trying to struggle with their feelings and work through them in a book, and her family takes it too far? That's the knife's edge that this trial is walking. Because once motive enters the room, it colors everything. And when motive is painted in story form, it sticks. Donna's team is going to continue to push back with everything they have. They'll argue that Wendy's mindset, no matter how vividly she wrote it, is not Donna's mindset. That what a daughter wants doesn't prove what a mother did or even wanted. And they'll argue that fiction is just that, fiction. Even if it walks the line of truth and talks like the truth, it's not evidence unless the law says it is. And they may have a point. Judges tend to be cautious with anything that risks emotional contamination in the courtroom. Fiction has weight, but not always the right kind. If jurors start reading between the lines, it becomes less about facts and more about feelings. And in a trial where the facts are already circumstantial, that's dangerous ground. Still, the prosecution seems to believe the risk is worth it. Because what they're really doing is building a mosaic, a pattern, a picture of a family whose frustration boiled over into action. And in that mosaic, the This Is Us story was just one title, but a vivid one. Whether, again, it is omitted or not, it has certainly started to shape how people view this case. And if the jury hears even a few lines of it, that emotional echo could be powerful. That's the prosecution's gamble, that fiction can sometimes reveal truth more clearly than fact. But the final word belongs to the judge. And if he allows it in, if it finds a way into evidence, into testimony, in the minds of those jurors, there could be some swaying going on. Only time will tell if Wendy's book makes an impact on the future freedom of her mom, Donna Adelson, and even possibly herself. There's a lot of questions in this case. We just have to keep waiting for the answers.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. The Smiths thought they found the perfect babysitter. Sweet, responsible, a glowing recommendation from the neighbors. She had a way with kids. Calm, patient, always smiling. But what the Smiths didn't know was that their perfect babysitter had been using that same glowing reputation to slip in and out of homes for years, quietly collecting little trophies from every house she entered. Bracelets. Photos. Sometimes. Something even more disturbing. If only they had known. If only they had heard the exact type of case like this, broken down on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before everyone else and caught on to the signs before it was too late. Instead, let's just say they're in desperate need of a new babysitter and some therapy. Subscribe now to True Crime Today, Premium Plus, on Apple Podcasts.